A man and an elderly lady was visible in this glass. They took the glass out and took it over to the Smithsonian, but they had no explanation for it either.
So then?
The Smithsonian never sent it back.
I mean, it's still maybe there with a photographic likeness of the people still in the place?
As far as I know, it was there. That was the last place it was recorded.
They
were
the best kept secret.
Well, this was...
You know, there's a case of this famous Rabbi Elijah,
yes,
Wilno, who had the curse, as he put it, of memorizing every book that he read. And he could start anywhere in the book and quote forward or backward, verbatim. And at the time of his death, they estimated that he had committed to memory more than 2,000 books. John.
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, and this is Long John with the Party Line.
It was the unprecedented crime of committing murder by hypnotism.
This was in Denmark.
Yes, Denmark.
Do you know, are there any other countries in the world where a hypnotist was imprisoned for committing
murder? I've never heard of one. That's why I used the story. It attracted quite a bit of attention, and there was a great deal of expert testimony in connection with it. And this, in a court of law and after due process of law, they decided that the hypnotist was guilty rather than his subject.
Well, how did this... when you did this research, did you find out how Paula Herdrup came under the spell of this hypnotist?
Well, I first picked this up from a wire service story.
Yeah.
And then later, through the Danish embassy, I got copies of the court records on the thing. It's a very fascinating thing. It was a long... long drawn-out trial. Of course, a great deal of the expert testimony.
Did you get any information at all as to how this man got into the hypnotism? How he was subjugated to this hypnotist?
You mean how he happened?
How did he happen to get involved with the hypnotist? Yes.
Well, no, I don't know that I don't recall that I did as to his particular testimony as to why he submitted. He was a kind of a weak-willed character to begin with, although he'd never been in any trouble. He'd never done much. I recall that he worked only irregularly, and he was not a very forceful individual. Nielsen, of course, didn't go to any length to tell why he did this, but the evidence showed that he
had. They were friends, weren't they?
I believe they were, yes. They were buddies, and... he submitted time after time to this hypnotic treatment.
Frank, just for a small switch of pace here, there is one very delightful story in your book about a porpoise.
Polaris Jack.
Yeah, why don't you tell us?
There is a monument to this porpoise, and of course there was no trouble in documenting this one because it was a matter of record. And it's been told actually quite a few times in various maritime journals. But this Pelorus Jack was a huge gray porpoise that appeared in the Straits of Pelorus. That's near French Pass, down near Australia, New Zealand, actually. It's a very dangerous stretch of water, and many a sailing ship had gone down in there striking the rocks in this treacherous current and these crosswinds. But this porpoise appeared one day and played along the bows of the ship. And when the weather got real bad all of a sudden, the porpoise stayed right in front of the bows and kept leaping along. And since the pilot had nothing else to go by, he followed the porpoise and came through the dangerous pass without any ill effects at all. He had a perfect pilot. And this porpoise actually worked this... life-saving business routine down there for about 40 years before he finally died, apparently of old age. But on one occasion, a drunken passenger shot the porpoise, and they thought that Jack had been killed. They saw that it was wounded, and he disappeared for quite a while, a couple of years, I think, and then he reappeared, and he led literally hundreds of ships through this dangerous pass and never lost a passenger. But the ship that... on which the drunken passenger shot him, he would never lead that ship through again, and it eventually was wrecked in there with a heavy loss of life. I guess we'd call that section the Porpoise's Revenge. But the grateful sailors and sailing companies erected a monument to him down there on the beach, and it's still there to this day. It's about 12 feet high, and it shows this porpoise leaping along, and on the base of it is the story of Pelorus Jack.
The porpoise crawled right in front of the ship.
When they got into the strong currents and narrow channels, he went right in front of the bows of the ships. But at other times, he played along beside them when they were in fairly open water and crossed back and forth under the ship, but seemed to be playing around like a puppy with a bone.
You know, I've watched them out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
Graceful creatures.
They come along there, and they're fantastic. They come out, and they sort of make a circular flash through the air, and they dip in and dip out again in those circular directions.
There's also amazing stories about porpoises recorded during World War II. About flyers shot down in the Pacific. There were one or two cases where a school of porpoises found a pilot shot down in the Pacific. And when he saw them swimming towards him, he became hysterical because he thought they were sharks when their fins were sticking out of the water. And these porpoises ganged up on him and started to nudge him towards, and started swimming along, buffeting him in front of them. And before long, they tossed him up on the beach of an island that he had not known was near there or anything else. They literally saved his life. I think it was recorded twice that it happened.
At the Greenland of the Pacific, south of L.A., these are probably just tricks that have been taught these porpoises, but it's an amazing thing to watch. They have a fellow who gets out on the plank over the submerged tank.
Yeah.
Have you seen these things?
Yeah.
And he pretends to be taking a picture with his little box camera and falls in. And when he starts floundering, this big porpoise comes and grabs him by the collar and just takes him flying across that tank and right up to the ladder and then throws his hat up after him.
Amazing thing about the training of these porpoises, Frank. I questioned somebody. It's not done, let's say, beginning with an infant porpoise. It is done with an adult porpoise. In other words, normally an animal to teach tricks, you will do it at the earliest possible stage and have that much more ability to do it. But here, these are full-grown, so-called adult porpoises that they can teach these tricks to. It's a very interesting aspect.
Yeah, they're a very strange story. This
Marineland
in Florida, that they had a shark, a baby shark was born, and the mother died. So someone got the idea of turning the baby shark over to a porpoise, and the porpoise took the shark. The baby shark, but the thing that they hadn't calculated on is that something went wrong with the baby shark, and a porpoise is a member of the whale family, so it's really a mammal, whereas a shark is a fish, and it breathes through fins, and the porpoise kept on, when the baby shark got sick, it kept on taking the shark and throwing it up in the air because it thought it was suffocating, and finally killed the thing.
I saw porpoises kill a shark at Boca Chica, right, you know, just outside of Key West one day. This shark was about 10 feet long, and he was up in this water, which is only about 6 feet deep. And all of a sudden, we saw these porpoises coming, and two of them hit that shark and knocked him all the way out of the water. And every time he'd hit the water, another one was smacking. And they were just ramming into the shark.
That's rather a curious combination. The shark is such a brainless creature.
Yeah, and boy, they battered him around, and in 5 minutes, he couldn't even swim. Finally, he just sank to the bottom, and that was it. But it took them about, I'd say, altogether 7 or 8 minutes to kill him, and there were about a dozen porpoises involved, and they were really battering him around. And the first time, when two of them hit him altogether at the same time, he came right out of the water. He was up 3-4 feet.
Just returning your book, I think what I appreciated most about it was the way you managed to crowd in all these very interesting stories and your ability to condense each story, which normally I think would be very difficult. If you're dealing in the unusual, I was going to say fantasy, but...
Well, be careful, don't say that.
I am careful. If you're dealing...
I have a grenade here that I'm lost.
Dealing in the unusual, I mean, the relation of the stories of that nature, that I imagine in writing them, it's quite a problem as to what to leave out, because everything is important, especially that of the unusual. So your ability to condense into 2-3 pages of book style each story and yet to me, not leave out, you know, things that should be told. Let me
explain something here. This, that was a problem.
I admit.
Because in many of these, I had a great deal of material that dealt with this particular story.
Yeah, and some of the chapters, you almost wish that you would have gone.
And in order to give a lot of variety to the book, and without that it would have been meaningless, in order to get variety into it and still keep it interesting without deleting any of the essentials and without going overboard on some of the stories, that is, running them out beyond the necessary length, I had to write and rewrite, which for me is rather unusual, but my problem was simplified to some extent because originally I wrote things for a radio series called Stranger Than Science, which is now running in five or six countries. We just made a deal with Australia last week to run these things, and I know they're running in Trinidad and Bermuda and Canada and the United States and Australia and several places. And so I had, in order to get these into radio form, I had to cut them pretty short and make them as compact as possible, as Detroit would say. And so that helped me to a large extent to keep from being overly wordy on these things and to at the same time get some variety into them.
We just received, somebody just brought into the studio,
a 5-foot show,
a very long telegram. And it says on the top of it, don't read. So I guess we're not supposed to read it. Maybe it's something metaphysical. Maybe we'll get a chance to read it later. Somebody can interpret it.
Maybe you'll rub it on top of your head.
We're going to decide that we won't comment on it because the person has requested that it should not be. Isn't that a lengthy
one? I thought
one?
You were hanging wallpaper on it.
Does it look it? Yes, well, I certainly want to study that in a little while. And I'd like to talk now about Carnegie Delicatessen and Restaurant, which is...
Is that the number of those cases, Ellery, that are on record, let's say in the last 150 or 200 years, there have been a great number of those things. And I mentioned several of them in the book here, where all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, in rather generally in localized instances, it would become just as dark as at midnight. And I think I have one of the cases in there in Minnesota where this happened, and also a case up in New England where it got so dark in the middle of the day that the this legislative body that was meeting had to light candles in order to get around in the room. And part of them wanted to adjourn and go home because they thought it was the end of the world. And the fellow who was in charge of the meeting said, if it is the end of the world, we'd better stay here and finish this business while we... And before it's all over.
What?
And there was no explanation for any of these that I was able to find.
Well, there isn't one of the usual explanations that is given, something like forest fire.
Well, there was one case, I think it was along in the, about 52 or 53, where there was the so-called Blue Days. Well, for instance, in the as a great forest fire in western Canada. But the gimmick, the joker to that was that if this was caused on our east coast by the forest fire in western Canada, it was on a day when the wind was blowing in two directions at the same time, because the charts show very clearly that the smoke from the forest fire in western Canada was going westward over the mountains and over the Pacific, and it was comparatively localized. And the thing that was not explained was how this same condition allegedly brought about the blue and green days over Denmark and Scandinavia about 6 or 7 days after it happened in this country.
There seems to be a connection between these events, then.
Well, I don't know about that. I just know that I found several of them, and although they were attributed to the same condition, in that case I just mentioned, this most recent one, in the early 50s, I couldn't see how they could, in view of the circumstances that are known to have existed, I don't see how they could attribute the same thing, these blue and green days in these other countries, to the condition in western Canada.
Have you gotten any reports on red days when the sky would be all red and the light would be red?
Well, of course, after the... explosion of Krakatoa back in the preceding century, there were some days like that. And although it's not generally known, there were some days like that immediately preceding the explosion of Krakatoa.
How is that accounted for?
I don't know. Of course, the ones that followed it were explained as the dust, and it may well have been dust from the explosion. But what caused the ones before that, I don't know, nor did I was I ever to find any explanation.
Frank, did you ever go to Duke University and visit the parapsychology laboratory?
No, I was never there.
Have you ever talked with Ryan?
Only by phone once.
Just by phone?
Yes.
Do you have any opinions about his work?
Well, I think that he's certainly a brave soul to venture out into that field, which is a cruise among the damned, certainly, because he is dealing with subjects which are highly controversial and which in many cases are regarded as simply non-existent or fraudulent. And yet he's had the courage and had the support of the university and has done, I think, some remarkable research in these various fields that he's dealt with.
Ben?
I wanted to ask about something on the flyleaf of your book where it mentions other titles. And I was wondering how you lost 10 million sponsors.
Well, as far as I know, I'm the only fellow who ever did lose 10 million sponsors, and I lost them all in one night. Then, at the time, this was in August of 1954, I had been sponsored on the Mutual Network by the AFML. As a matter of fact, I was the first news commentator ever to have a labor sponsor on a national basis.
And only one.
No, there have been others since then. But I was the first one to be on a national basis with a labor organization as a sponsor. I had some disagreements with a few of the hierarchy there at the AFL. By and large, I got along fine with those sponsors, as I have with many others during my 36 years in this business. And that covered actually only 4 years of my career. But it came to the point where we had to have a parting of the ways since we couldn't have a meeting of the minds. And I tried to resign and got fired. I have the footprints to prove it.
Also, the dedication in your book.
In this particular book, Stranger in Science?
Yeah,
yes, sir.
Candy, a devoted friend.
It sounds like Candy might be a strip teaser, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was wondering.
No, Candy in this case, Ben, it happens to be my little Boston Terrier, a real cute little scamp. And she was on a lot of television shows with me when I was out in the Midwest doing nightly television news commentaries. Candy got to coming in and climbing up on my lap, and so one night, in order to make it a little easier for me, I put her up on the desk and told her to lie down, so she did. And she would lie there and watch the camera lens almost motionless all during the show. But when I said my sign-off, good night, good news, and good luck, she knew what that meant, and she'd bounce up like she had a spring under. And she got to be real popular, in fact, more than I. And it got to the point where I was really, I think, just a guest on her program. And she's a very well-behaved little scamp and really rules the roost at our house. So I thought the least I could do is to dedicate the book to her.
You'll win a lot of friends and a lot of readers for that little pitch there, believe me, because we have a lot of dog lovers. I know we've had discussions about, I'm thinking of Peggy Fitzgerald. Quick, give me the...
Good one.
What?
Peggy Fitzgerald?
Yeah. No, I mean, Peggy Fitzgerald's pitch about vivisection.
Oh,
I know. And any time there's a discussion about vivisection, we have all of the animal lovers, and believe me, they'll be happy to know.
I did a big fight on that. Well, I was on that AFL program along in the 50s there, and I got into it through Estelle Taylor. Remember her?
Yes.
And she was, of course, then living in Hollywood. She's died since then. But she knew how I felt about that. When this fight came along, why she got my interest, I went out there and spent some time and did quite a campaign on it. But Estelle was a wonderful fighter for the underprivileged pooches. And so I had a lot of fun and a lot of fine support from Ms. Taylor and others in the field.
When you represented the AFL on that news program, your news comments, were those written by you and uncensored by the AFL?
Well, they were written by me for about 3 years of the 4 years and uncensored. But in about the last, I'd say perhaps the last 10 months of my tenure or my term of service there, they put a fellow on with me who was called an editor. But actually, he was a censor, and he was put on there to see that I carried out his orders, and they certainly didn't coincide with my idea of news coverage. And I fought him off for a while, but I finally got tired of that, because actually he had the support of a couple of fellows who were in a strategic position there, and I couldn't possibly win in the long run, so there's no use fighting indefinitely a battle that you can't win. But by and large, my relationship with the AFL during the 4 years or so that I was with them was very good. I mean, with the exception of the last few months, and why they took that tack, I'll never know, but I'm not particularly...
Well, you were not anti-labor. That's a sure thing.
Well, no, I...
So then, what would they want to censor?
Well, they wanted to be sure that I quoted some AFL bigwig about every other night.
I see.
And, for instance, one of them had made a trip to Germany at the AFL's expense. Well, he went over there actually to visit his grandparents. And when he came back, in order to justify, in fact, I was surprised. I didn't know he had any grandparents. I thought they won him at a raffle. But when he came back, he wanted, in order to justify his having spent all this money, he wanted me to carry a 3-minute tape of the conditions, the economic conditions in West Germany as he had found them during his 3-day stay there. So I cut the tape in two and used part of it. But this was typical of the problem that I had.
Well, Frank, in all fairness, the AFL, it is also typical so often of commercially, that is, sponsored news programs sponsored by commercial organizations, is it not?
Well, I have never had that experience, Al. I can't recall a single instance where I've been sponsored by a commercial organization where they tried to get me to carry some big story plugging the sponsor as an individual.
Yeah, this is...
And that's what this would amount to.
This is sort of... annoying thing. You like to think that the, you know, that only the opponents do this. Sort of, and I was thinking of Congressional Junkets when he brought up that trip to Germany, and it was very amusing to find out that the AFL did it also.
Well, I don't condone it, of course. It's improper from either source, but again, in all fairness, it is done both ways. Many a president of a corporation, or a lower echelon officer for that matter, takes a little junket, be it to Europe or elsewhere, on a really personal situation, but he is surveying the market.
Oh, yes.
So he is...
Studying world conditions.
Studying world conditions, etc. No question about it. Either side, it seems improper.
Well, I didn't object to this fellow spending the AFL's money. That was none of my business. In fact, I worked for the Mutual Network then, as I do today. But I was sponsored by the AFL, and that was an arrangement between Mutual and the AFL. And it was none of my business how the AFL executives spent their money, but it was my business when I was put in the position of carrying a propaganda piece for one AFL executive under the guise of news to help him cover up a private junket to his grandmother's knee and other joints. And I just didn't prefer to do that.
Oh, you know, did it put you out of action for a while?
Well, only briefly, actually. When the dust settled after that, when I went to work out at American University there in Washington, making some films for television. Incidentally, the first one we made had Willie Ley and Jonathan Leonard, the science editor of Time magazine.
Yes.
And they were, on the other side of me was Major Donald Kehoe and William Nash, the veteran pilot for Pan American Airlines. And the subject of our 30-minute heated discussion was, what are the flying saucers? And the fur was flying as well as the saucers.
There's something, Al, for you to think about a moment. I've known you now, I guess, for about two and a half years.
It's and 20, doesn't it?
It's But in talking with you many times, you have suggested to me, and I know that you meant well, you thought that you were giving me constructive criticism and suggestions,
You suggested that it would be nice if we dealt once in a while with theatrical people and, you know, sort of get away from the offbeat subjects of flying saucers. And yet, here's a man that you have a tremendous amount of admiration and respect for, Frank Edwards, and you see that this is, I would say, a major portion of his discussion, but certainly an important part of the things that he discusses. And there's interest. A definite interest, a tremendous interest on the part of listeners.
I don't doubt it. And when a man of Frank Edwards' caliber, and I am not being pleasant to him because he is present this evening, I said it before I ever met him, then I am willing to listen and to discuss. I agree with that, John. Where I had spoken to you before and again with sincerity and trying to be constructive and not saying that I know everything, I just felt this, that offbeat in itself can be interesting, no question, but its validity sometimes when it comes from a person who is just offbeat themselves without any background whatsoever might be misleading and might at times also be boring. But if a man of Frank Edwards' background and he finds interest, well, then he's a credible source. He's a reputable source. It is interesting to talk to him. That was my only point. The source of the information, rather than the information itself, was what I thought was important.
What about, would you put Major Donald Kehoe in that same class here?
Well, of course, you're putting me in this spot because you're naming individuals, but since you're asking me to do it, and I am often called foolishly courageously, no, I do not put him in Mr. Edwards' category whatsoever.
I didn't mean as a news commentator. I mean as an authority on saucers.
Well, as an authority on saucers, that's a difficult question. As an authority that I'd like to listen to.
Well, let me say this. I personally feel that Kehoe is far better informed on the subject of UFOs than I am. Because he has access, because of his military background and connections, he has access to a lot of friends in the service who will talk to him off the record and discuss things with him which I could never get.
Frank, excuse me. Possibly, this may be so in Major Kehoe's case, I don't know. But the fact of his majority is certainly not ipso facto to be accepted that he has sources of information. Because I might allude, I had an officership in the reserve of the Army of the United States.
And it took a long while to win that war. Go ahead.
At ease. And I might allude,
I knew there was something about you I didn't quite like, you know.
I got along very well with the men. Very well indeed.
Let me tell you how it was at San Juan Hill, fellas.
You're right.
You, Johnny,
Eddie Rose,
will like
it. Oh, I was there.
Finish the story.
No, seriously. So the fact that Major Kehoe, I don't know, has a majority, doesn't mean he has military friends and sources that he gets information from. As a newsman, your ability to obtain news, although some people may be reluctant to give it to you, I think it would be far greater than any of the thousands of ex-military officers roaming around now in all sorts of positions that have nothing to do with
me. Well, let me explain this to you, Al. I don't know how much you know about Kehoe, but he was a major in the Marine Corps in World War I. He also was a balloonist and balloon instructor prior to World War I. He taught flying during World War I and afterward. He was aide to Colonel Lindbergh when Lindbergh made his triumphal tour of the United States. And he has been a renowned aviation writer for a good many years because of this very fine background as a flyer.
No.
When he was a balloonist, did he use hot air balloons or aerobian balloons?
Well, you may be interested in knowing that he preferred gas.
Oh,
that's beautiful. I have a lot of respect for Major Kehoe, and I think that he is doing, and I know that there are many people that are critical of him. Certainly, he is not making a lot of loot in this.
I can tell you this, that Major Kehoe has lost a lot of money.
I know that, yes.
And has taken and is still taking a terrific financial beating because of his courage in staying on this particular subject because he thinks it's something.
When this was originally organized, it looked like there were going to be a lot of big people involved in it. They were going to put money into it, and Major Donald Kehoe would get a tidy income from it, which he's entitled to for the work and the knowledge that the work he puts in and the knowledge that he has of the subject. But something happened. What happened, I do not know. I've heard a lot of rumors. Nevertheless, there was a certain deterioration in the organization, and Kehoe was the only one that stuck with it and kept the thing together. And whether you buy Donald Kehoe's ideas or not, this is a man that is sincere and a man that is doing what I consider to be an excellent job. At any time that Kehoe wants to step out of there, he could make a classical buck touring the country lecturing. He doesn't have to fool around with...
His election as the director of this organization, John, was by the unanimous vote of the board, which consisted of some eminent scientists, some generals like Whittemeyer, and some admirals like Forney, and men who had known Kehoe and known of his work and of his background, and they voted unanimously and for him to head the organization. And I think the guy, as you pointed out, who deserves a great deal of credit, and certainly he deserves something better than he's had financially, because this has cost him personally a very great amount of money.
Yeah, but I don't understand what he's doing. I mean, they were all commending him and applauding him and tell me what he's doing.
Well, to put it bluntly, he's starving, do you understand?
Yeah, but, you know, no one...
That's a serious question of mine.
No one grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and said, give up your lucrative business associations and appointments and the rest of it.
May I just interrupt you? Basically, that's what was done at the time. A group of men decided to form NICAP.
And they forced him against him.
Oh, no, not Ben. Let's not be facetious about it. They approached him and they told him that they wanted him to head the organization, and with great reluctance, he decided to accept their offer.
What was he doing at that time, Jones?
He was writing books. He collaborated with Charles Lindbergh on one book. He wrote a number of articles for the top magazines, Saturday Evening Post, True Magazine, Argosy Magazine, and the now defunct Literary Digest.
Yeah.
And he's a very competent writer in his particular field. He was lecturing and all, and he decided to get behind this thing because he believes, and I think he still does, that he believes that we need an organization in Washington to try to bring to the public the facts about, I won't call them flying saucers, about UFOs. Now, it is his opinion that the government is concealing some of the information that they have. This is not necessarily my opinion, but if a man is so sincere in his belief, then I think he deserves our respect and admiration.
Sincerity always. May I ask Frank a question? Do you believe that the government is withholding information on whatever knowledge they have of unidentified flying objects?
Sure
you do. That they have some answers to the question.
Well, that they have a great deal more information than they will put out. Now, NICAP has a letter from Nathan Twining. We had written to him, and I think this was over the signature of Admiral Hillencutter, asking him if any attempt had been made to contact these things or to communicate with them, and if so, what the results were. And in his reply, much to our surprise, General Twining said that attempts had been made, but the results had been negative because of what we assumed to be physical reasons. We asked him to amplify that physical reasons, and we did not get a reply to that.